welcome to episode 13 of Girls on Pop. I'm your co-host, Marina Antunes, joined today by fellow co-host.
I am Ashley Lynch.
So, Miss Ashley, lots has happened since the last time we talked. Where do you want to start?
Oh my God, has it ever? Okay, well, I think the place that we need to start at is the fact that Warner Brothers basically just announced that they're going to be releasing, what is it, like 17 of their films, their entire 2021 slate. Yeah. At this point, they're going to be sending simultaneously in theaters and streaming to HBO Max. And this is huge. Basically, an entire studio has committed to saying, our movies are just going to go straight into your home. We're bypassing theaters. Like, even though they're still going to theaters, let's be real. Most people, they're going to be watching them at home. And this is a huge paradigm shift for the entire industry.
Yeah. Oh, you're not kidding. And I mean, it had a number of interesting repercussions. I mean, the first was, I'm pretty sure that the AT&T stock probably skyrocketed. Theater stocks plummeted to, like, is it possible to go below zero? Maybe. I don't know. And what I thought was really, really interesting. I mean, on the surface, this really felt like a ploy to, bump their subscriber numbers for HBO Max, which is currently still only available in the US. So that's a bit weird. But the really interesting thing that I found was sort of the aftermath of that announcement, because they basically like announced it on a Friday, and over the weekend, like, basically everybody chimed in, including the directors some that they unceremoniously dumped into the streaming platforms, and others that were just upset about the whole thing. And I have really mixed feelings about the entire thing.
Yeah, you're not wrong. And like, not just the directors and fans too, but apparently even Warner Brothers itself, because apparently this move was a lateral move by their parent company, AT&T. And when they made this decision, they basically gave everyone like an hour of lead time on the announcement and just said, hey, we're doing this. And I guess not even Warner Brothers is particularly happy with this idea. The directors definitely aren't happy with this idea. Denis Villeneuve, who directed Dune, wrote this scathing op-ed for Variety, where he was basically just blasting Warner Brothers, saying, you know, it's like, I get it. My movie deserves to be in a theater. You should see this on the big screen. At the same time, While I don't disagree with that, I'm like, also look around you, read the room, dude. You know, it's like we're in the middle of a pandemic and it is not safe to go to a movie theater. So it's gets back into this place where the studio is stuck between, do we just let these movies sit on a shelf and continue to accrue debt and basically become more expensive? It's like this giant thing that's just sitting there. Or do we release it in some other form because the theaters simply are not safe? And Tenet kind of proved it. You can stick it in theaters, but it doesn't mean that mass amounts of people are going to show up. And that movie paid the price for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, I love Denis Villeneuve. I love his movies. I think he's an amazing filmmaker, and I'm sure he's a lovely human being. Everything I've ever seen with him, he always comes across as this very caring, very compassionate, very sort of in the room person.
For sure.
All the complaints that I've seen about this move have been white dudes, basically privileged white dudes that get the opportunity to spend millions of dollars making these amazing movies that, yes, we want to see, but you're complaining about something, people are still going to see your movie and they still have the opportunity to see it in a theater if they want to. So your ultimate fans, your film buffs are still going to make a trip to the theater to see the movie because, let's be honest, they agree with you. Everybody else probably may have not seen it in the movie theater anyways, at least certainly not during a pandemic. To me, it just feels like a bunch of white dudes crying and it just kind of pisses me off. On the other hand, I think it was kind of a really dick move for AT&T to do that without, you know, first consulting with one, the studio, and two, the creators that you've been working with. I mean, Warner Brothers, for me at least, has always been, at least in, particularly in the last decade where franchise films and cookie cutter movies have kind of become the norm, Warner Brothers has kind of been this like mountain that has these amazing creators that they work with, that even when they're working within like something like a Dune or a Batman or even a DC universe, those films have all felt very unique and personal to the filmmakers. They're like a filmmaker studio. Mm-hmm. And so it does feel like a really stupid move on the part of the parent company to alienate their creators. But then who else is going to step up to take these orphaned directors now? Disney?
I don't know. Maybe we can get a whole new generation come in. You know, maybe they can do an overall deal with someone like Nia DaCosta instead. You know, instead of giving Christopher Nolan $300 million to play with every year.
Yeah, and I thought it was really interesting that the one filmmaker that came out, perhaps not so much in defense, but not really crying about it, was Patty Jenkins. She's mm-hmm. like, this is just the reality of things. I'm like, so great. The one woman making like a big action movie for Warner Brothers is okay with this, but the boys are upset.
Yeah.
Cry me a river.
And again, it's like, I get it. I'm always going to defend the theatrical experience because to me, that's a magical place. I have so many great memories of going to see movies in the theaters. I'm very worried that the end result of this pandemic is going to be that theaters just aren't a thing anymore. And it's entirely likely that theaters will entirely restructure how they do business. They may become more big ticket event places, if they even exist at all at the end of this. So we'll have to see what happens. But I don't want theaters to go away. And I love seeing movies in the theaters. At the same time, yes, you are 100% right. It's like, at the end of the day, what you need is you need for people to see your movie. If you make a movie and no one shows up because no one feels safe to go to the theater, then it's not a movie, it's just masturbation. Mm-hmm. I want to quote something here. So see Robert Cargill, the writer of Doctor Strange and Sinister. He tweeted this out recently, and he said, the average American sees 5 movies in theater per year. Less than 1 in 5, around 18%, sees 10 or more. These are pre-COVID numbers. In 2018, there were 993 theatrical release films. 434 of those made less than 100,000 theatrically. Only 277 made more than 1 million. And of those 141 that made more than 10 million, 35 made 100 million plus. So that's just the reality of the place for the theater in movies. A majority of people who are watching movies, they are not watching them in the theater. Most people only see between 1 and 5 movies per year. That is a very small amount compared to the number of movies, even the number of blockbuster movies that are released every year. I mean, just of everything that Warner Brothers announced for this slate, and this is one studio, there's probably at least 5 to 7 like big tentpole films that you're like, oh, I got to see that. You know, it's like, do you want to see the new Godzilla versus Kong movie, or do you want to see Dune, or do you want to see Matrix 4? There are huge movies in here. And so the reality is most people are simply not going to the theater to see these movies anyways. So it almost seems like an inevitability that we're going to end up in this hybrid situation where movies are going to theaters and they're also coming to a streaming platform at... I almost think that it's better to do like the releasing at a higher price to rent it rather than go to the theater, rather than just say, hey, everything's on our streaming platform, please subscribe.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think that I read somewhere that day and date release on the streaming platform is only for a month. So after that, like, what happens to it? Does it come back in 6 months?
For HBO Max.
Yeah, for HBO Max.
Yeah. I imagine then they'll start moving stuff to iTunes and mm-hmm. other places like that. But that's the other thing. So we talked about on the last episode how Wonder Woman 84 was going to be coming to that was the big news that week, was that that was going to stream into HBO Max, which made sense because that movie was supposed to come out in what, June or July or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's just been like sitting there languishing ever since. And now it's getting a Christmas release. And the one thing we didn't mention is that, and you said this at the top, that HBO Max is a U.S. streaming service that is not available in Canada. For, you know, the people listening to this podcast that are in the U.S., that's great news. For those of us in Canada, that really sucks. And the outlet that has, that basically gets the HBO content in Canada is the streaming service Crave. And Crave has said they're not going to be getting it day-and-date release. It is like a separate kind of distribution deal that they aren't the recipient of. So that means that Wonder Woman 84, if you want to see it in Canada, you need to go to the theater or, you know, just sucks to suck. But now that has changed, where they have said that they're going to do a day and date release in Canada on streaming services. They didn't say what. I'm expecting iTunes and probably Google Play, maybe Amazon. For Wonder Woman 84. So in Canada, you will be able to stream it. And I believe the price is $30 on Christmas Day. So that's great, where they're, you know, they're scrambling to come up with solutions for the streaming problems, because international deals do not apply all the time. And finally, we're actually going to get that at the same time as the Americans. So that's awesome.
I agree. It's worth also mentioning that for Wonder Woman fans everywhere, DC Fandom is doing a virtual world premiere on Tuesday the 15th at noon Pacific. So, and it's streaming free on their DCFandom.com, I think it is.
Oh, so awesome.
Worth bookmarking your calendar and checking that out. I didn't see a pre-registration or anything, so I think you just kind of show up on the day of. I did. Have you used the DC Fandom? Did you participate in that event that they had earlier?
There were a few things that I looked at during their last big, their big press event where they unveiled a bunch of new things. I watched a few of the trailers for big things that they unleashed, like James Gunn's The Suicide Squad, and also a couple of the DC based games that they have coming out. The Suicide Squad game from Rocksteady looks like it could be pretty cool. And I'm a little iffy about I can't remember what it's called, the Gotham Knights, I think it's called, game that's coming out. It looks like it might be one of those sort of like games as a live service multiplayer games instead of a story based game. And it's like, after the Avengers one that came out, I'm a little burned out on those games because they're always there to more just like make money than they are to be fun games.
So I'm curious, getting back to this Warner Brothers situation, where do you fall as far as, are you discouraged? Are you still going to watch these movies, or have you called it quits on Warner Brothers?
Oh no, I'm going to watch the hell out of these movies. There's a bunch of these that I am genuinely excited for and was looking forward to. Like I am a huge Matrix fan, and I will watch anything the Wachowskis do. So I am very excited about a new Matrix, and I have no idea what this story is going to be. It's like, where do you go from where they left it off? Wait, didn't Keanu die at the end of the third movie? He basically got like, you know, integrated as part of the machines. And it's like, okay, I don't know what they're doing, but whatever it is, I am there for it.
So I'm with
very
you.
Excited about that. I'm a little more kind of like tepid on Dune just because it's not, you know, a property that I'm like massively in love with, but I do love Denis Villeneuve's work. And so I'm definitely going to check that one out. And
I'm such a Dune fangirl, have been since high school.
Yeah.
So I'm very much looking forward to seeing how he interprets the material.
Well, here's a story that I heard recently that I thought was kind of amazing, where, you know, for almost all of his movies at this point, Hans Zimmer has been doing the score for all of Christopher Nolan's movies. I think it's been that way since Batman Begins. And they have like this very kind of yin and yang partnership between their filmmaking. However, Hans Zimmer did not do the score for Tenet. And the reason was, apparently, Zimmer had been saying for years, because he's a huge Dune fan, he said, if Dune ever comes back around and gets made, I am going to do the score for that movie. In fact, I already have it written. Because he was like, he was very passionate about this property and even had like this entire score in mind that he wanted to do for this film that didn't even exist and wasn't even developed yet. And it's just like, it was his thing. And so you had Dune, which was basically going to be in production at the same time as Tenet. And so he had to say, sorry, Chris, I can't do your film. Dune exists. And so Hans Zimmer went and did Dune, and Chris Nolan had to get a different composer for his film.
I love that story.
I love that because it shows like the passion that Hans Zimmer had for Dune. And you do get that sense that the people who were working on this film had incredible reverence and passion for the project itself. Probably the most since the ill-fated Jodorowsky's attempt at making the film, mm-hmm. which never actually happened, but all those creatives splintered to the winds and basically created an entire era of sci-fi, everything from Alien to Blade Runner after that. So what are we moving on to from here?
Let's talk Spider-Man 3.
Yes.
Now, you brought this to my attention because I had no idea there had been movement with Spider-Man 3. This is how out of tune I've been. But holy crap, what the fuck is going on?
So it's been slowly boiling where, I guess about a month ago, they announced that Jamie Foxx was going to be reprising his role as Electro. He was, of course, in The Amazing Spider-Man 2, which was basically the first reboot of the franchise, the one with Andrew Garfield. And then it's like, okay, well, is he playing like the Electro from that movie? Are they bringing back like that Electro? Or is it they just thought, well, he's good as the character, so let's just like do another Electro character and have Jamie Foxx in the role. And then it just came out, and there's been a whole slew of announcements following it, but Alfred Molina is going to be returning as Dr. Octopus. And so like now the picture starts to become a little bit clear. So we have a Raimi era villain and the Andrew Garfield era villain in this MCU era Spider-Man film. So clearly they're doing the multiverse. They're doing, you know, Into the Spider-Verse, basically. The animated film, but as like live action in the MCU. And the quick and easy shorthand that they're able to do is like, let's draw from the other existing films and people's knowledge of them to illustrate the multidimensional, you know, world in theory that exists in Spider-Man and the MCU mm-hmm. at large. So the idea that like all these different versions of Spider-Man that we've gotten, the Sam Raimi films, the Andrew Garfield films, and now the current film are all just different multiverses within the same universe, which is a neat idea. And the cast has even exploded past that. Now we've got actually Andrew Garfield and
Tobey Maguire.
And Tobey Maguire are going to be returning. And then also Kirsten Dunst is going to be there. And currently they are in talks with what's her name? I'm blanking.
Emma Stone,
who played Gwen Stacy in the Amazing Spider-Man series, who died in those films. So I'd be curious to see what happens there. And, of course, Doctor Strange is going to be in this one as well.
Yes.
So, you know, which sort of, like, gives you your link to, like, how multiversing happens. So it's going to be very interesting. And I don't know if I'm into it or not. I'm just going to, like, because I've loved the other Spider-Man movies in the MCU, I've loved these Tom Holland movies. I'm going to trust them that they know what they're doing and that I'm going to like the end result. But all of this fan service is leaving me a little bit exhausted. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, and that was kind of what I was feeling. I mean, I liked the two Tom Holland movies. I thought they were both really good. Overall, I'm generally a fan of Spider-Man anyways. I liked the Andrew Garfield ones, though the movies weren't quite as good. I mean, I liked that interpretation of the character and the other characters within that universe. And I'm actually probably a really big fan more than most of the Tobey Maguire. Now I don't even know what they're called. The Spider-Man 3 is probably my favorite of the bunch.
Oh, I adore. You don't need to defend Spider-Man 3 with me.
Okay, good.
I am a huge Sam Raimi fan. You know, to the point where, like, there's a book out there called The Evil Dead Companion, all about the making of the Evil Dead movies, and I'm mentioned in it. So it's like there, my love for Sam Raimi's films knows no boundaries. And as a result, it's like I even love his jankier, more like I'm going to insert the Three Stooges goofiness into stuff. I think that's part of the charm of what Sam Raimi does, where like it's not always, I don't want to say sincere, but there's definitely a lot of winking and a lot of goofiness that goes on that if you're not ready for and if you're not primed for, it can seem really off-putting. But if you're into it, it is wonderful. So those bits in Spider-Man 3 where he's like doing the evil dorky Peter and he's like walking down the street and pointing finger guns at people and the whole dance sequence in the club. I think that stuff is amazing. I absolutely love that. And everyone else cringes at it.
No, you and I are in the same boat because those are my favorite moments. And when I think of Spider-Man, quite honestly, that scene of him walking down the street with those finger guns, that is what I think of. It's the first thing that comes to mind. I love it. But I just don't see, like, I'm with you. I mean, I'm hoping they know what they're doing, but I'm like, how the fuck are you going to squeeze all of these people into a movie? I mean, I think the animated film, The Amazing, did an amazing, amazing job. But I mean, part of the charm of that film was that it was so unexpected and it came out of left field and it visually, it has a very unique look and it was a very different take on the material. Now, like a live action kind of derivative of that feels just like that, a derivative. And I can't get super excited for it. I just don't know how I feel.
Well, and we still don't even know what this is. For all we know, all these, you know, characters returning, it may just end up to being cameos. This may end up being like a bunch of people sandwiched into like a 5-minute sequence of like chaotic nuttiness for all we know. So it's really too early to kind of see exactly where they're going with this film. Everything that we're speculating right now is based entirely off of casting. They haven't even really revealed anything about the storyline of what this film is going to be about. So it may be a little bit too early for us to jump the gun and deciding what this is, but it definitely very clearly they're doing the multiverse thing. And you're right about Into the Spider-Verse, the animated film, where that movie, it's one of the best movies I've seen in probably the last 5 years. It is such a brilliant, tight, perfect little movie. And it is so well written, and they thread a very difficult needle through that entire film. That is a hard movie to land, and they landed it perfectly. And it's almost like trying to capture lightning in a bottle twice. And I want to say that this film can do it, but at the same time, I'm skeptical. But I'll be positively skeptical, and I will pleasantly wait for whatever they you know, show me before I start poo-pooing it.
And I will say this, I would be, even though I think you're right that it could be that they may just be cameos, it would also be equally disappointing if you have all of these amazing people in one movie and they all have like a 2-minute scene together. Like, that would be so sad.
Yeah. And I mean, like, maybe this is the problem with like the, you know, with having like, you know, 100 different like movie fan blog outlets and, you know, to a degree, maybe even what we do a little bit, where it's like, just needing to constantly generate this news. Whereas, like, before, like, 20 years ago, we would have found out when we sat down to watch the movie. And we would have been, holy shit. But now all of these, you know, all of these characters being in this movie, it's like, well, it's now just a known quantity.
Yeah.
But I think they're also using it to try to, like, stoke up anticipation. Like, oh, my God, this is going to be amazing.
I agree. I mean, I hope it's good. Fingers crossed. Let's just wait, sit on it and see what comes out next. We'll have to wait to see.
Absolutely.
The other thing that I wanted to talk about that happened very, very late last week was Disney's major, like, mind fuck of an announcement.
Oh, my God.
Like, I mean, I think it's fair to say that it was unexpected because there wasn't a whole lot of buzz about, you know, this Disney event that happened. And all of a sudden, Disney unleashes, like, I don't even know, I lost count, maybe like 10 new Star Wars projects, TV shows, animated, live action, movies, like everything is in here. It's crazy.
Yeah, maybe there was some preamble for this thing. I'm not sure, but I didn't even know it was happening until I started seeing things on Twitter. It's like,
yeah.
Oh my God, what the hell is happening? And it's just like, I don't know what your relationship with Star Wars is, but mine is at this point fairly tepid. I think I'm a little bit exhausted by Star Wars. I'm definitely a little bit exhausted by how, since Lucasfilm sold it to Disney, how they're like, well, now we can just churn out a lot of Star Wars. And it's, I think a lot of these series, they're going to be released over a long period of time. I think we're looking at like 5 years out for a lot of this stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's not going to be as much of an onslaught as it appears. But when they do these events, and I think probably Marvel was the one that started this, I think Kevin Feige started this whole trend, where they would have like the press conference and he'd go, here's phase two of our, you know, of our movies, and, you know, just show a bunch of title cards for all these movies, and everyone would freak out. It's like, oh my God, they're finally doing Captain Marvel. Oh my God, it's Black Panther. And, you know, generate a lot of excitement that way. And now everyone wants to do this. And so Disney's doing the same thing where it's like, and here's 11 Star Wars shows and 5 Star Wars movies. And while this stuff is going to trickle out, by unleashing all this stuff on us in one press conference for like what's coming in the next 5 years, it almost feels like we're getting waterboarded with this stuff.
It's true.
Like I asked for a drink of water and now I'm drowning, and it makes me not want to be excited about any of it is the side effect.
Well, for me, I have a very, I don't care about Star Wars. Like, it, to me, it's not a franchise that I grew up with. Mm. So it's not something that I have like a deep affection for. It's just another franchise as far as I'm concerned. I've liked some of it. I haven't liked some of it. I don't watch a lot of it. So to me, it's all very, I kind of pick what I like and what I don't. And I watch a lot of it because my husband is a big fan and he did grow up with it. But for me, I'm very selective about what I give my time to, because there is limited time. So I haven't watched a lot of it. I mean, I watched the movies, but I don't like most of them. And that's just the reality of it. But I will say, I have a love hate with Disney, because I too feel like I'm very concerned about the fact that they own such a large, disproportionately large.
They own like half the industry at this point.
Well, this is it. And to me, that's very frightening for the diversity of the content that we consume. I will give them this much. I think it's wise on their part that they are doubling down on basically their the fact that they've diversified their creators. So, you know, you look at that slate of projects and you have Diego Luna's executive producing a bunch of stuff. You have people of color in a lot of the lead performances. You have women in creative roles. So, I mean, I do like that they're finally moving forward with a slightly more diverse group of creators. I don't think that we should give them a lot of credit, because out of those 11, there's maybe two or three that have, you know, people that aren't white dudes. However, I do appreciate that they are sort of bringing into the fold these different viewpoints and these different creators. The one title out of everything that I saw that I went, holy fuck, give me this movie now, Patty Jenkins doing Rogue Squadron. No mm-hmm. idea what this is going to be, but fuck, give it to me now. Like, I want this movie tomorrow. I'll give Patty Jenkins on all money for the rest of eternity. Just give me all the things that she makes.
Oh, for sure. I'm there for Patty Jenkins. The other one that got me is, I'm not even sure what the film is yet, but apparently Taika Waititi is going to be doing a Star Wars film as well.
Oh, yeah. Bring it on.
Yeah. And one of my favorite things was, this was on Instagram. The Star Wars account posted out, you know, that Taika Waititi was doing a film. And Taika Waititi responded to him and said, "What? As a longtime Star Wars fan, I'm so angry about what I'm about to do to ruin it."
I love him.
I know. He is such a treasure. It's like Thor Ragnarok was, it's absolutely the best Thor, and it's one of the best Marvel films, and I just love the kind of audacious sense of humor that he brings to all the stuff that he does. And I wouldn't have thought it before, you know, to watch like some of his New Zealand films, but he's actually a really good fit for these big franchise films. So as much as I'm with you about not being huge on Star Wars, I will be there for whatever Taika Waititi does.
And honestly, I have really been genuinely enjoying The Mandalorian. I mean, I don't know a lot of the history of the character. Dan, it's one of my husband's favorite characters is The Mandalorian. So he was really keen on the show to begin with. And I've genuinely really enjoyed it. I think the storytelling is really interesting, and it's different. It feels different than the other projects in the Star Wars universe. It feels a little darker and a little more adult, which I really like. And I just like the sensibility of it. So I do think that they've done some really good things with that show, but it also feels, after watching sort of like the behind the scenes, it feels that they kind of gave it to Jon Favreau and let him do his thing with it. And it's worked out really well to their benefit. Mm-hmm. So I think as long as they keep their hands out of the creator's way, I think we're in for probably at least a couple of really good interpretations, but I mean, I'm not going to watch all of it. That's just the reality of it.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I'm behind on Mandalorian. I haven't seen any of season two yet. I still need to catch up, but I did really enjoy season one. It won me over. And I think they're finally starting to do with Star Wars the thing that I've wanted them to do, and I think a lot of people have been asking for them to do, which is just branch out and tell other stories. It's like you have the giant universe. Not everything needs to be set around Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker. And this is the thing that I found most frustrating about the movies, is it feels like it's a franchise that is helplessly mired in nostalgia, where it's trying to play to, like, this film that was made in 1979. Like, you have new films come out like, Rogue One, which is basically just a prequel movie of how did we get to the first Star Wars movie. And so much of it is just fan service and nostalgia and pandering. And I find a lot of it kind very boring and insufferable. I mean, apologies to anyone who, you know, absolutely loves those movies, but I find my patience with them growing more and more thin. And then you have something like The Mandalorian that comes along where it's like, well, it's just in this universe. It is not about those characters that we seem to be like anchored to, like a ball and chain in the films. Mm-hmm. And it is infinitely more entertaining and enjoyable because you don't know where it's going to go. There are endless possibilities for what it can do, essentially, taking place in that world. And then with a lot of these other films and shows that are coming out that they announce, it seems like they're moving in that direction. But mm-hmm. they're also moving in that first direction, too, with shows like Obi-Wan Kenobi. And it's like, I don't care about Obi-Wan. His story's done. I feel like we got everything we need from that character. I don't care what he was doing in between movies.
Yeah, you and I are in the same boat.
Well, we're lacking for diversity of opinion on that one, but it's definitely nice to know that there's someone else in my corner on that one, because sometimes, especially on Twitter, I feel like I'm like the only person who's like, he's willing to fight for this one.
Yeah, no, I'm very indifferent to Star Wars, so I generally don't even bother with the argument to begin with, because I just don't care. So sad. So let's wrap up with what have you been watching? What's been entertaining you lately?
A bunch of stuff. So I've been watching more horror content lately, more indie horror content. So the first thing I want to mention is I watched Possessor, which is Brandon Cronenberg's new film. Brandon Cronenberg, of course, being the son of esteemed Canadian filmmaker David Cronenberg. And this movie is about a woman who essentially works for some mysterious organization where they have technology that allows her to essentially hijack someone's brain and control them like a puppet, basically like take over their body so that she can go and assassinate people. And she goes in and basically finds the target and kills them. And then she has to essentially kill herself so that the host's body basically disconnects and she can be pulled out. And she runs into problems where, because it's not just like a complete takeover, it's essentially this nightmare situation where two people are existing in the same body, where the host body just doesn't actually want to kill himself. He's very much against it. And so she can't actually pull the trigger and make the suicide happen so that she can get out. And so it becomes like this fight inside the body for dominance as she tries to get out after taking out her target. And it's a very strange and trippy movie, very esoteric and weird. And if you love that sort of thing, and it depends on the film for me, and this one actually really worked for me. It was a lot of fun. It was really interesting. It was really different. It's also incredibly brutal, too. There are two versions out there, the regular version and the uncut version. I watched uncut. And if you ever want to see Sean Bean get an eyeball pried out of his head, this is the movie for you.
I'm a big fan of Brandon Cronenberg. I think it's hard when you have a last name like Cronenberg to not be compared to your father, especially when you're working in a very sort of not far from the tree vein. I mean, Antiviral clearly, like his debut feature, clearly was one step removed from his father's work, but it was still very much a sort of Cronenberg kind of approach. And I think with this one, I think this is a far superior film. I mean, I really liked Antiviral. I had some issues with it, but I thought it was a really solid debut. But this feels like the same filmmaker, but a way more polished one. I don't know what he's been doing for the last like 8 years, but Possessor is kind of like on another level, because he not only ups the visual and sort of physical manifestations of the storytelling, but the storytelling is so much more intricate and much smarter and much more nuanced and subdued, which is totally against the visuals of the film, which I think is spectacular. It's one of my favorites of the year. I haven't seen the uncut version yet. I do need to get around to that before the year kind of wraps up. But I did see the earlier version from earlier in the year from one of the festivals, and I was blown away. I watched it twice back to back. I thought it was spectacular. And it really is like, if you're into, I think you're right. It's not for everybody, but if you like a challenge, this is definitely up there and it's worth searching out. And it was named one of Canada's top 10 films by TIFF. Not that it's the be all end all, but it's notable. And I think worth mentioning, and I'm with you. I think it's definitely one that people should search out. And really Christopher Abbott for everything. I love Christopher Abbott. I think he's completely undervalued as an actor, and I'll watch pretty much everything he's in, carte blanche.
So, oh yeah, it's the entire cast for the film is terrific. Yeah. Christopher Abbott is really great. Andrea Riseborough is very great in the film as the hit woman who basically takes over his body. It's it's definitely a very unique and very interesting film. I don't know what the difference is between the regular and the uncut version. I imagine it's just a few small inserts of like some extra gore. Some of it, which is, you know, very difficult. So depending on what your tolerance level is for that. But it's also, I got warned by a lot of people how graphic this film was. And honestly, it's as someone who watches a lot of horror movies, wasn't that bad.
Yeah, so I'm with you. I thought it was, I mean, on the scale of viciousness, I'm like, it's not terrible. Like, I've seen worse.
Yeah, like, it all depends on where your tolerance levels
exactly
lie. You know, like, if you watch the Evil Dead remake, this is tame by comparison. So it all depends on where your sense of issues lie. You know, it's like, there's going to be some stuff which, like, everyone has a thing that, like, oh, if that happens, then, like, I can handle all the gore. But if I see someone lose a finger, that's, like, something that just, like, genuinely upsets me. Everyone has something like that. And this movie will have something that, you know, is guaranteed to, like, oh, that's one of my no-go areas. Because, like, no body area is really safe. But one of the things that I found interesting, like, of course, Brandon is always going to kind of suffer from being compared to his father, who, like, responsible for so many amazing and incredible groundbreaking films like Videodrome and The Fly. And I kind of understand why Stephen King's son goes by the name Joe Hill now instead of using King, so that he can separate himself apart. But at the same time, Brandon is definitely coming into his own and becoming a very interesting, unique filmmaker. And it probably helps that his father is a little less kind of proactive in getting films made these days. But I also thought that even more than comparing it to David Cronenberg's work, this film felt like it owed more to Vincenzo Natale.
Yes.
With a lot of his kind of like paranoid sci-fi sort of films. It felt like a very, like a more graphic version of a film like Cypher than anything else. So I saw a lot of those roots in there. So that's definitely what he's doing is definitely not entirely similar to what his father's doing.
Yeah, you're totally right. But the comparison to Natale is bang on. That's great.
Mm-hmm. Other Canadian royalty.
Yes.
Who most people will know directed the movie Cube. That's probably what he's most famous for at this point.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I would say I'm a big fan of Natale's. I think probably my favorite of his films is Nothing, which a lot of people haven't seen, and it's quite different than everything else. But
which is a bonkers movie.
Oh, it's crazy. I love it.
Yeah.
Him and David Hewlett, they're hilarious together.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you're right. And a more Canadian sci-fi royalty for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So the other movie that I watched was the Blumhouse film Freaky.
Oh, I saw this one too.
Which is basically, it's basically Freaky Friday as a horror film. So it's like, what if Laurie Strode from Halloween and Michael Myers switched bodies and had like a comedic horror adventure going on. So that's basically the premise of the film, where you have the teenager played by Catherine Newton and the mass murderer who switches bodies with her, played by Vince Vaughn. And you end up with a lot of really good comedy early on, as Vince Vaughn is basically playing a teenage girl trying to convince his friends that this really huge, you know, serial murderer is actually their teenage friend, and they need to now stop this serial killer that's in her teenage body and going around the high school murdering people in increasingly vicious and outrageous ways. And one of the things that, not all the film works for me, but there were a lot of elements that really did. And one of the things, the recurring joke that's really funny to me is how, because it's like Vince Vaughn is a big guy, it's like sometimes in the films that he's in, you don't really see it. But in this film, they really emphasize it, where he's actually a very large dude. And as a result, this teenage girl in his body, he's throwing his weight around and doesn't really, it's like kind of surprised by like, oh, I actually have a lot of weight now. When I like hit someone, they actually like go really far. And the opposite with the serial killer inside the teenage girl body, she's sort of like remembering a time when it's like, oh, I could pick someone up by their neck. And that doesn't work anymore because I'm not strong enough. I'm not big enough for that. I am no longer imposing. When I like jump on someone and try to murder them, they can actually throw me off now.
Yeah.
So I don't know what was your take on the film? How did you dig it?
I really did enjoy it. I'm not a huge fan of horror comedies, so they have to be pretty on the ball for them to kind of work for me. Mm-hmm. And I have a very weird sense of comedy anyways, so I tend to like comedies a lot of people don't enjoy. But I thought it was a lot of fun. I actually didn't really clue in on the physicality of it as far as like the sizing. So I think you bring up a really interesting point. The thing that I found most amusing really was Vince Vaughn as playing a teenage girl. I thought he embodied that really, really well, and the physicality of it was really
funny. He goes all in on this performance.
He does. And I could appreciate that. And I think the movie works because he's so over the top, and it was just so fun to watch. So fun to watch. I had a really good time.
And I was also kind of surprised at how legitimately gory and creative some of the kills were in the movie. It's really kind of paying homage to sort of like its 80s roots in that sense. Because there's two types of films that Blumhouse makes at this point, where they will make like the legitimate like Halloween, you know, sequel movies, where it's like, we're making horror movies for adults. And then they've also tapped into, we're making horror movies for kids, stuff like Happy Death Day to You and Fantasy Island, stuff like that, where it almost feels like they're playing more towards a PG audience. And I expect this to be very much more in like the Happy Death Day to You camp. And I was surprised when it's like, oh, she just split a guy in half.
Right?
You know, it's like there are some, and a lot of them are like really creative kills, where it's like you have that sort of thing in the Friday the 13th movie, where it's like the anticipation of like, oh, how's Jason going to use this object he picked up to, you know, murder this teenager? And there's almost a sadistic glee in like how creative can they get with murder. And this film really plays into that. It's like how over the top can we get with the ways in which she can murder people? And it ends up being a lot gorier than I thought it would be, and fairly entertaining too.
Yeah, I fully, fully, fully agree. I thought it was way more fun than I had anticipated. So it was great.
So that one's definitely worth a watch. Right now it's like full price on iTunes because it just got released. So maybe it'd be a little bit more worthwhile waiting until that one comes down a bit in price before renting it. But it's definitely worth a watch.
Anything else that you want to mention?
Yeah, I'm going to mention this just because you tweeted at me about it on Twitter. It's a thing that I'm doing where I just decided to go back and rewatch all the Mission Impossible movies.
I love it.
And like every once in a while, I'll go back and watch them. And I just felt like, you know what, it's time to do a rewatch of the Mission Impossible. So I started with the first film and I just like watched all the way through. There's what, 6 films now, and there's like 2 more coming out in the near future. Chris McQuarrie and Tom Cruise are, you know, currently working on the next 2 movies in the series. And this is a franchise that I deeply love. I've always loved Mission Impossible. I remember staying up at 2 a.m. when I was a young kid and discovered the original 60s show that was like playing in reruns on some channel, and I would stay up late and I would watch Mission Impossible with Peter Graves. And I loved it then. I loved the movies when they started coming out. And the movies, honestly, in my opinion, have just been actually getting better, which is rare. I think they fully figured out what these films are. And so I created this thing that I dubbed hashtag Merry Cruisemas, where I'm just watching Tom Cruise movies. And it was really just the Mission Impossible thing, but people seem to be loving this idea so much that maybe I'm going to be watching more Tom Cruise movies this season. I don't know. I think
I'm always for more Tom Cruise.
It'll probably have to accumulate, end with watching Eyes Wide Shut, because that is like the Christmas Tom Cruise movie. It's like, maybe it's like the anti-Christmas Tom Cruise movie. I don't know.
Oh, I love it.
But that's the one that actually takes place at Christmas. So it seems like that's the right one to end with. So I don't know how many more I'm going to do in this whole series, if I'm going to go to like Top Gun or Days of Thunder or Magnolia or, you know, Edge of Tomorrow, how far I'm going to take this. But there'll definitely be more Tom Cruise movies that are happening between here and Christmas.
I think it's really funny because I am an unabashed Tom Cruise fangirl, and I go through phases where I kind of go knee deep on Tom Cruise. And recently there's been Days of Thunder has been on TV nonstop for the last like 5 days. And I swear to God, I've probably seen the movie 3 times over as I flip through channels. And I'm like, oh, Days of Thunder is on again. Okay, maybe I'll just watch a little bit. And next thing you know, it's like 45 minutes in and I've watched a quarter of it already. I'm like, I might as well just finish it now. We were watching it this morning again. And the thing that struck me about Days of Thunder is, fuck, I really miss Tony Scott a lot, a lot, yes. a lot. But yeah, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I think you're totally on the ball with the Mission Impossible movies. It's one of the few franchises where they do get better with everyone. And I really like Tom Cruise. He puts it in. He goes like all in for everything. It doesn't matter what movie it is, what role it is. And, you know, I can appreciate that. And he's fun to watch.
One of the things that I find really interesting and funny about Tom Cruise's career is his midlife crisis was basically becoming the Jackie Chan of North America.
Yes!
It's like his entire life now is about how I'm going to do action films and I'm going to do all the stunts myself and I'm going to do insane stuff that the insurance companies don't want me to do. And you end up with some incredible things in these films. Like rewatching Ghost Protocol, the Burj Khalifa scene where he is climbing up the side of the tallest building in the world and he's legitimately doing is still absolutely amazing. I've seen that scene maybe probably about like 10 times by this point. And still, every time I watch it, my heart goes in my throat because it is so intense. And this is a dude who is past 40. How old is he now? He's probably even like 50.
Yeah, he's like 50 or 52, something like that.
Yeah. So this is a dude who is now in his 50s. And he is doing basically constantly risking his life to make these movies now, which are, you know, popcorn entertainment.
He's almost 60. He's 58.
Oh my God. And it's just bonkers to me. But like what you're saying about like how he commits to films, that's one of his great powers. It's like not only does he not sleepwalk through anything or phone anything in, he is absolutely 100% committed, but he is like overcommitted to a pathological level. Like in the last Mission Impossible movie, there's a scene where he jumped between buildings and he ended up breaking his ankle in the jump. And then they kept filming and he ran on his broken ankle.
The extras, like one of the reasons I hope that Blu-rays and DVDs and like physical media never dies. I love, like, there's some movies where I just love the extras. The Mission Impossible movies and pretty much any Tom Cruise movie, usually the making ofs are like spectacular because they have so much material because they actually physically did all that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
I love it.
And it's, you know, Tom Cruise, he basically owns the Mission Impossible franchise. And he produces all of these films. He has since the very first film. It's very clearly like, this is his baby. And what's wild is he is very much in tune with what the audience wants. And he's very committed to like delivering them a spectacular experience that they're going to enjoy, even to the point of risking his own life. And it's a little bit psychotic, but it's also incredibly admirable. And he's very clocked in at this point to what these movies are supposed to be and delivers an incredible experience. He insists that each one of them is shot on film. He insists that these are actually stunts that are being performed, and as much as possible being performed by the actors. And being the lead actor in each of the films, he can put himself in the position where it's like the only ones he has to like fight to be able to do the stunts is basically the insurance company. Yep. And apparently they have to go through like a whole rigmarole to trick the insurance company where basically they'll set up like this ridiculous stunt that they'll never say yes to, and they use that as a way to get the insurance company to agree to this other ridiculous stunt, and then they'll pull that first big stunt out of the film.
Yeah.
And so now they're like, oh, now I can actually do a scene where I have to swim underwater for 4 minutes and hold my breath.
I love it. The stories of the making of those movies is just insane. I love it.
And the result is a series of films that are so entertaining and still hold up and are so much fun. And unlike anything else that is out there, there's no other action series out there that is similar to what Mission Impossible is doing. So I absolutely love it.
Yay, I love it. I love the concept of the Christmas.
Yes. Any chance I have to make up a goofy hashtag.
I'm all over this one. It's happening. It's happening.
Absolutely.
I want to mention three things, and I'll do it very quickly because we're already running a bit long. But the first is there's a four-part docuseries on HBO called Heaven's Gate, The Cult of Cults. It's super, super interesting. So it runs for about 4 hours. Each one is about an hour long. And it's basically a deep dive into Heaven's Gate. And it's really interesting because they turn back the clock all the way to the 1970s when they started their first round of recruitment. And they talk to some of the survivors, people that basically didn't go on the mission. And it's just fascinating. It's really, really interesting. It's an interesting look not only at this particular cult, but cults in general. And just amazing, amazing, amazing that some of the survivors still actually believe this stuff. It's crazy to me, but super fascinating. Highly recommended. It's great.
I absolutely need to see this. I think it's an incredibly important topic right now with the advent of what QAnon is right now, which let's face it, it is a cult and it is sucking people in and destroying their lives. And so I think it is very important. We were talking last episode about the Keith Raniere's cult.
Yeah.
And I started watching that second series as well. And this, I think it's incredibly important to kind of examine the history of cults and how they have sucked people in and what it's done to people's lives so that people are more aware.
Yeah.
Of you know, how this, like, I think a lot of people think of cults as like not a thing that exists anymore. And it very much is.
Oh, it does.
And, you know, everyone is, it's easy to think of people who get sucked into cults as being rubes or being stupid or being compromisingly vulnerable. And people never think of themselves that way. But the truth is, for cults and grifters alike, everyone has something where they have like a button that if someone can figure out what that button is and push it, they can suck you in. No one is immune to this stuff. And so I think it is very important to be more aware of how these organizations operate. So exactly. I'm definitely going to check this out.
And the interesting thing with Heaven's Gate specifically is that it had such a long gestation. Like, they started doing their first round of recruiting in the early 70s. Like, I think it was 72. And, I mean, the event didn't happen until 1997, which is 20 years later. So it's really, really amazing. And I mean, most of the members were in it from the beginning. So it's amazing to get some insight into how this particular cult the long road, I guess, to the finale. It's just fascinating. It's so, so interesting. So I highly recommend people check it out. It's definitely worth searching out.
Definitely going on my list.
The other two things are more like PSAs because they're not technically out yet, but I just wanted to pimp because I'm a fan. So the first is Skylines, which is the third of the Skylines.
Okay.
I'm such a fangirl of these movies. Admittedly, they're probably not great, but they have a real sense of joy and just batshit craziness that really works for me. And I've really enjoyed, like, the first one I think is legitimately good. And the second one is good because it's just so wacky. And the third one is more on the, it's even wackier than you would have expected. They're just so joyous to watch. They don't take themselves too seriously. They're just fun. And so the third one is available as of December the 18th. So I guess next Friday. And I'd say it's, if you're into kind of goofy alien movies, it's probably one to check out. There's aliens doing like kung fu. It's so awesome.
I have not seen any of these movies yet, but I do know of them, and I did watch the trailer for the third one. But the first movie, if I recall, was a little bit of like an impossible Marvel in the sense where it was done ultra low budget by a small team of guys who actually had industry VFX experience and said, hey, we can take what we know to we can do with visual effects and we can make a movie that looks like it was made for $50 million, but make it for like $500,000. And yep. and that was the first film.
Yep. Pretty much. And I mean, it's followed that trajectory a little bit because it's still a very scrappy group of, well, it's Liam, the director, Reuter and director now, and a very small crew of visual effects artists basically doing all the work themselves. So it's, there's still that going for it. The thing that's really interesting about it is, I guess, because in part because of funding, the film also has a really international flavor. Like the second one was partly shot in Thailand and partly shot in LA and partly shot in Europe. And so they've, along the way, they've also picked up these really interesting actors. So they have like Thai actors and British actors. And this one is even more of the same. And it just, it feels like it could be totally out of place, but it oddly works. And it feels more like the real world than almost anything else, because it is such sort of a hodgepodge of people. And I just think there's fun. They that's the thing that I like about them, is that they don't take themselves super seriously. And they're just really light, entertaining, and they're fun to watch, and they look pretty good. They look better than your average low budget sci-fi movie. So that definitely helps. So
yeah, they absolutely do.
Yeah, I like the sensibility of these. So I'd say that if you like the first two Skylines, it's totally worth checking out. It's more of
a it definitely looks like it's like blown up and got like a lot huger. Whereas like the first one was just the entire thing took place in a condo.
Yes.
And this one looks like, oh, now it's just like big global alien war.
Oh yeah. They take the fight to the aliens. I love it.
Yeah, so the scope in these films has absolutely exploded, which is pretty amazing. This film series is an incredibly unlikely success story.
Yeah, I love it. And then the last thing that I wanted to PSA is The Expanse season 5. So the first two episodes of the new season will be available on Amazon Prime on Tuesday the 16th. So I technically can only talk about the first two episodes. Let's just say it's really good.
Okay. So the
series picks up pretty much immediately after season four wraps up. The first couple of episodes are pretty awesome. It's setting up quite nicely for the rest of the season. So I would say that if you're a fan, you should definitely mark your calendar, because you don't want to be left behind when these start dropping. It's good.
That's awesome. I never really got into The Expanse. I watched a couple episodes and I kind of bounced off, and I kept hearing how amazing it was. And I keep meaning to go back and give it another shot, but it just hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, we were pretty, it took us a few years to get into the series. Like, I think we'd watched one or two episodes when the show came out because everybody was raving about it. And then we kind of lost track of it and then didn't come back to it until probably season 3 was released and everybody was super high on it. And so we mainlined the first two seasons. I will say this, I think for me, season 1 is probably the least interesting of the seasons, because it feels like they only thought they were going to get one season. So the story feels very small, and those usually work for me, but the universe is, they kind of kept hinting at this bigger universe at large that they never really got to explore. And I felt like I was a bit like being cheated. And then by the time you get to season 2, you really get to like know the characters, and the political overtones really start to sort of show. And the show is way more sort of like political intrigue in space, with a little bit of like the space stuff that you might come to expect from like a television series about space. But it's way more about like the people and the drama and the political intrigue, but not in the way like that Battlestar Galactica dealt into that. I don't know. I mean, I wasn't a huge fan of BSG, but I latched onto The Expanse in a really weird way. And the show is just, it just seems to be getting better with every season, because they're not feeling like they're married to what's come before. So every time it feels really fresh, and you're like, okay, so how are they going to tie it back? How are they going to bring everybody together? What's next? What's still out there they need to explore? And it's like, you want, your mind is telling you that, but the show is not delivering on that. So it's very, very fascinating. The first couple of episodes of season 5 are really setting it up for a really great season to come. So recommended. Oh, that's awesome. For sure. Thumbs up.
That's awesome.
And that's all I've got. I'm so behind on end of year stuff. I have no idea how I'm going to catch up.
Oh, I know. I feel like I've almost given up in catching up, air quotes around catching up, because it's just like, you know, it's just like the same reason, like I fell off The Expanse so quickly. It's like, there are just too many things to watch. I have a pile of like, you know, 10 movies and 5 shows that I still actually want to get around to watching. There just isn't enough time for all this stuff because there are too many shows to watch. So it's, we're it's both a blessing and a curse that we have this much content, but it gets to a point where, like, I felt like there was a time in my life where I could say, yes, I can keep track of all the things, but now I've just had to say, nope, there's some stuff I'm just going to let that go. And I'm going to be more selective about the things that I spend my time on.
Yeah. I have a lot of films that I need to watch and that I do want to watch. And I feel so overwhelmed that what we did was literally, I can't decide what movie to watch. Let's watch the new season of The Expanse. I did that.
At the same time, how much can I complain about how there's no time to watch anything new when I just rewatched Mission Impossible for the fifth time?
You know, it's sometimes you just need that, the comfort watch.
Exactly.
You know, you just need to give in to that. And with that, I thought we were going to have a short show and an hour in.
Oh no, there was way too much to talk about this week.
It's true. But we'll link to all the stuff that we talked about in the show notes. So be sure to come on by etcpod.ca and check that out. And we'll be back maybe before the end of the year. I'll throw it out as a question because we'll see how scheduling goes. But we'll be back fairly soon. So until the next one, everybody.
All right.
Opening and closing credits are Happy Alley by composer Kevin MacLeod. For more information, visit incompetech.com.